hat Israel, Baum im Schma Israel.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generation.
The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. On Monday, March 20th, 1950, there died in New York City, at the age of 46, a man of scholarship and mercy. He was the rabbi of the Park Avenue Synagogue. His name was Milton Steinberg. Milton Steinberg asked that no eulogy be spoken for him. Instead, after the hymns he loved had been chanted and the psalms had been spoken, his own son Jonathan read the concluding section of the last book of the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius.
Man, thou hast been a citizen in this world. What matters it to thee if for 5 years or 100? For under its laws, equal treatment is meted out to all. What hardship then is there in being banished, not by a tyrant or an unjust judge, but by nature who settled thee in it? So might a director who commissions an actor dismiss him from the stage. But I have not played my 5 acts, only 3. Thou sayest well, but in life 3 acts count as a full play. For he that is responsible for thy composition originally and thy dissolution now decides when it is complete. Depart then satisfied, for he that dismisses thee is satisfied.
No eulogy, therefore, from us for Milton Steinberg. Let us go instead to the 3 acts of his uncompleted drama, his own writings, his sermons, his essays, his novels, his books. The 3 acts of Milton Steinberg, they speak now this memorial for him.
We begin with Milton Steinberg's distinguished novel, As a Driven Leaf.
There was a rabbi of the Sanhedrin whose name was Elisha ben Abuya.
You know what it is to be unfriended. You know what it is to be shunned, to be despised, to be hated. I know. I know, and I will tell you that the bruise is not from the clenched fist, but from the face averted. The pain is not from the flung stone, but from voices sudden in silence. From windows shuttered, from the dreadful emptiness of those whom you have wronged, of those whom you love, and in whose lives you no longer find a portion. It is 1800 years that I'm dead, but I know. My name is Elisha ben Abuya. I was a traitor.
This, the story of As a Driven Leaf, the story of a renegade, a betrayer, a story told with tenderness and compassion, a story of a scholar unable to surrender the liberty of his mind to authority, who tried to prove faith through reason alone, and being unable to do so, denied the necessity of faith. In the 25th chapter of the first part of the novel, Elisha ben Abuya and Rabbi Akiba hold a dialogue in a ruined garden.
Rabbi Akiba, I wish to begin at the beginning.
Yes, Elisha.
I want to lay aside all prejudices, all preconceived notions. Akiba ben Joseph, you are a wise man, a learned man. Akiba, how can you, knowing as much as I, how can you still maintain a naive faith?
The purpose of life is to live well. Whatever contributes toward that end is right and true. My first and last criterion concerning my proposition is, does it help man to live better?
Surely, Akiba, all wisdom will die with you. Every rogue who seeks to persuade someone else of a lie can justify himself by insisting that because of the lie he will live better.
You are deliberately making an absurdity of what I said.
No, Akiba. If there is no God, it is a lie to speak about him, no matter how well such a falsehood functions. Your willingness to accept doctrines on blind faith and then to defend them on grounds of expediency...
Elisha, by what right do you presume to call my attitude blind? Is it a darkening of counsel to admit that truth is not a matter of the mind alone, but of the heart and experience also?
And at this point, Akiba ben Joseph argues the necessity of faith.
He who wishes to trace a circle must first select out of all space one point about which to draw the circle. The choice of the point makes possible the line which circumscribes it. The utility of the circle in practice will determine ultimately whether the point has been well placed. So with faith. It is the axis about which we move, an axis that must be posited as an act of will. The faith of man determines whether he has located it properly. That is all I am saying, Elisha. That belief is the beginning, that it may be tested by experience, but that it must exist, or nothing can be.
Akiba ben Joseph, forgive me, but you are speaking arrant nonsense.
It was to be expected that you would say so, Elisha. To speak of faith to the man without faith is like communicating the experience of color to one who is blind.
Such is the conflict of the novel. But more than the novel, the inner tensions in Milton Steinberg. For at the age of 20, he was already a brilliant instructor of Latin and Greek, who abandoned his university career in order to become a rabbinical student. His own Hebraism versus his own Hellenism, a decision of faith. Born out of the struggle of the soul, out of perplexity, out of torment. And this same intellectual torment he framed for Elisha ben Abuya.
How can the soul make a truce with mystery when the mind cries out for understanding? How, Rabbi Akiba?
Elisha, there is no truth without faith.
When the Sabbath candles shine, one like Akiba finds light and serenity, while one like Elisha ben Abuya raises his candle high like Job to challenge the presence behind all things.
Wherefore hidest thou thyself from me? Wilt thou harass a driven leaf?
And so in the last chapter, Elisha ben Abuya, who has deserted his people for the sake of reason, who has betrayed the elders of the Sanhedrin to the immaculate hostility of Rome, who has dismissed simple loyalty to one's own people as irrational feelings, Elisha ben Abuya finds the wormwood bitter in his mouth. Akiba ben Joseph is dead. Joshua ben Hananiah is dead. The patriarch of the Sanhedrin is dead. To Elisha ben Abuya there is left only the day of the shadow and the city of death. And out of the shadow there comes Rabbi Meir, who has seen his sons dead and his wife bereaved, but who has maintained faith.
Merciful God, how you have changed, Elisha.
It's Meir. Rabbi Meir now, isn't it?
Yes, Master.
You call me that after everything.
Forgive me, Master. Oh, Elisha, did you have to serve the Romans so completely?
I don't understand that myself now.
And Meir, asking what Elisha ben Abuya has found, receives this answer.
I have found what I have known almost all my life. All truth rests ultimately on some act of faith. I have gone questing for what I possessed initially. A belief to invest my days with dignity and meaning. A pattern of behavior through which man might express his devotions to his fellow. It has all been a long journey in a circle.
On a night of angry winds and dripping rain, they brought the news of Elisha's death to Rabbi Meir. And when Meir found the open grave, he slipped his cloak from his shoulder and draped it like a blanket over the spot. Sleep through the night, he prayed.
quoting the words of Boaz to another tired traveler. From the cemetery down the hill, from the grave at his feet, and from out dead yesterdays, ghosts came stealing. And he wept, not alone for his master, but for himself as well. For a woman who rarely smiled, for sweet children who slept nearby, for a people crushed and persecuted, for all the sons of men, their aches of the body and soul, and their dreams that die. As a driven leaf belongs to a formative period of Milton Steinberg's Judaism, from this time on his Hebraism shone clear, a Hebraism of compassion. And this compassion found expression in his daily life and in his sermons. On Yom Kippur evening, many rabbis preach, and some choose a text from Scripture, and some a parable from the Midrash, and others a saying of the fathers. And yet it is not unseemly, even on Yom Kippur evening, to draw a text from the world, perhaps even the world of Shalom Aleichem.
There is a little story by Shalom Aleichem called A Pity for the Living.
The story of a boy who discovered the pain of all living things. The pain of a dog that was beaten, of a cat scalded, of two birds stoned from a tree, of a little girl struck down in a pogrom. And out of this slender story, Milton Steinberg built a sermon for our generation. Its text is now a part of Jewish tradition. Listen now to a few excerpts from that sermon.
Of some verses, the ancient rabbis used to say, "This is the kind of verse that comes up to you and insists, preach about me."
And this is what Shalom Aleichem's A Pity for the Living has done. It has come up and said, "Preach about me." And this is what it tells me I should speak of.
First, a hard, tragic fact of life.
Second, a moral inference from that fact.
And third, a wonderful miracle which follows the fact.
The hard, tragic fact is the universality of suffering. All life is a great fellowship of anguish. Each heart without exception knoweth its own bitterness, inhabits its own private hell.
And the moral inference is a simple natural deduction from the tragic fact, the thesis that since all things suffer, all things merit our pity.
This is the great foundation stone of all Jewish ethics, that a man must have mercy on everyone and everything, whereas to be pitiless is a grave sin, perhaps the gravest sin of which man is capable.
The words for this melody are Rachem, Rachmonis, Hebrew word signifying compassion, for rechem means the womb in which the child is born. There is a Greek word for womb which also connotes a mother's feeling, the word hystera, the same word in the Hebrew, compassion, in the Greek, hysteria. By rechem, rachmonis, by his sense of pity, shall you know the Jew.
For a Jew, if he be truly a Jew, is compassionate.
And the crucial fact about man is that man is always pitiable.
Therefore, there is no time or occasion on which we are free not to pity him. Pity one another.
There are you. Here am I.
Each encased in his own skin.
Locked up in his own skull.
separated by space.
Self-contained.
Self-centered.
To preserve my life, I may do the most shameful and desperate things. And not for my life alone, for my comfort, my pride, my wealth, my prestige. What is more, we are so made that we shrink from pain.
Why borrow the pain of others?
We have enough of our own to endure.
Still, we do borrow more pain, don't we? We borrow pain when we pity one another. This is the miracle. You think this borrowing comes easily, or that it is a small thing, or unworthy of notice? There is no miracle unworthy of notice, least of all this miracle. And yet before we pity a person, we must first like or approve of him. But before we can approve of the person we pity, we must first approve of ourselves.
Because in pity, we and the other person become one.
If we dislike ourselves, how can we like him?
And being unable to like him, how can we pity him?
The sadist cannot pity. He hates others.
The masochist cannot pity. He hates himself.
Pity begins with self-respect.
One may pity wrongly, stupidly, unjustly. Pity is a feeling. But when pity is controlled by justice, then pity becomes the ethical ideal. The ethical ideal of mercy. Now we begin to see why mercy is a sign not of weakness, as Nietzsche argued, but of strength.
A stupid person cannot pity. He lacks the imagination.
The immature person, the narcissist, cannot pity because he is unable to concern himself with anyone else.
The morbid one, the person who hates himself, cannot pity, because the effect of his identification with others is that he comes to hate them also.
The immoralist can pity, but he cannot be capable of conscious mercy, for he lacks standards of justice.
The truth is that only a healthy soul is capable of pity, and only a strong mind is capable of mercy. The words are still rachem, rachmonis, compassion. Always we must return to compassion. The final decision must always be with the human heart. Let us pity the living, all the living. Let us approach each other with a special gentleness. Husbands and wives, parents and children, friends, man to man to the beast in the field. As comrades about to embark on a high but perilous enterprise might link arms on setting forth, or as a child about to enter a dark chamber might reach out for his mother's hand. Rabbi's sermon for Yom Kippur evening. Let us turn now to the epilogue of Milton Steinberg's book, A Partisan Guide to the Jewish Problem, and to a question.
Is Judaism worthwhile? Is the game worth the candle? 6 million European Jews butchered, millions more spewed forth, naked and homeless to the four corners of the earth, their achievements so ruthlessly expunged that in countries where they sojourned for generations, scarcely a trace of their passage remained. And not only now. Look backward into history, into weary centuries of economic suppression, social ignominy, personal humiliation, expropriation, expulsion, massacre. Is the game worth the candle? Shall Israel not cry out, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life"?
A hard and a bitter question, and Milton Steinberg proposed his answers.
Let us suppose that the Jewish people had not created anything in its entire history, not a single idea or concept, not even one. Would its life career have been worthwhile? Yes.
Because for 2 millennia and more, Jews were the universal minority, the dissenters of every land and epoch, when the whole civilized world worshipped Caesar as God. This people alone denied him adoration.
When Islam prevailed from the Pyrenees to India, Jews broke the even texture of its domination.
In every country, in every generation, to the threshold of the present, they were different. By their very existence, therefore, they made absolute uniformity impossible. This, then, was the Jew in history, a voice singing in private, apart from the mass chorus, an irrepressible heckler to the official and respectable thesis of every age.
Heresy sprang up wherever he walked. By his refusal to deify the Roman Caesar, he all unawares broke a path for the Christian church.
He exerted a strong, if unpremeditated, influence on the rise of Protestantism.
And against violence, against the seduction of bribes, against the barbarities of the Middle Ages, Jews were steadfast.
Argue that their obduracy was stupid. But drawing on their own souls, they were stronger than the world. They could be killed, but they could not be made to surrender their truth. The truth established at 10,000 funeral pyres. That the human spirit can be stronger than any coercion exerted against it.
And at their hands, humanity received its classic religious faith.
By their prophets, mankind first was instructed in the infinite worth of the individual, the unity and brotherhood of men, the supremacy of justice and compassion.
From Judaism and Jews stem the great religious systems of the Western world.
Doctrines and moral writings.
Sacred writings.
Patterns for worship and piety.
Designs for ritual.
Schemes of ecclesiastical organization.
And, as Heine put it, there is not a battlefield of thought on which Jews have not fought and bled. In all campaigns of the modern spirit, they have participated as soldiers in the rank and as generals. From their loins sprang some of the great heroes of the human mind.
Spinoza and Bergson.
Marx, Lassalle.
Einstein and Heine.
Let alone fractional Jews like Montaigne, Felix Mendelssohn and Proust.
Consider, the total number of Jews in the age of Spinoza was less than 1 million.
In the time of Heine, only 4.5 million.
In the days just before Hitler, under 16 million.
The amazing creativity of a people which never achieved the dimensions of even 1% of the human mass. Tell me, what price shall we put upon this record? What price, from the first words of Genesis to the latest scientific paper by Einstein?
And at the same time, at what value shall we estimate the suffering and anguish of all Jewish generations? At what value? If the adventures of the intellect and the questings of the heart are taken for the chiefest glories of human existence, then you cannot measure the value. If it was worthwhile that Jeremiah sit in stocks at the temple gates so that out of humiliation he might come to know the things for which a man may be proud. If it was good that Socrates play the gadfly, though in the end it meant on his tongue the bitterness of death. If the Sermon on the Mount outbalances Golgotha. If the child compensates for birth pangs, then Judaism outweighs its cost.
I see in Eretz Yisrael a Jewish commonwealth where the homeless of the world have found rest. I see the Jewries of the world each at ease and firmly rooted in the land of its residence. I see an American Jewry emancipated along with all other Americans from the restraints of prejudice, secure against violence, free to fulfill itself without hindrance, an American Jewry alight with a religious faith, hallowed by antiquity and responsive to the mystery of all things, yet sanctioned by the best in modern thought, and clean with reasonableness. An American Jewry literate in both its heritages, creative in both, cross-blending and fertilizing the two, until all devotion to one shall connote blessing for the other as well. And should a day come when the world is ordered, when human affairs are everywhere consecrated, then, only then, glance backward over mankind's long, weary pilgrimage and ask of yourself, is the game worth the candle? Milton Steinberg, rabbi, teacher, scholar, poet. He is dead. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the dimly burning wick shall he not quench. I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness and have taken hold of thy hand. If you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 10 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to the Jewish Theological Seminary, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. Our eternal light drama today, Milton Steinberg, A Memorial, was edited by Morton Wishengrad and was based on the writings of Rabbi Steinberg. Roger DeCoven was the narrator. The music was composed by Morris Mamorski and conducted by Milton Katims. Cantor David Putterman sang the liturgical music. The production was under the direction of Frank Papp. We wish to thank Behrman House for permission to use the book As a Driven Leaf, and to thank Bob's Merrill for permission to use the book A Partisan Guide to the Jewish Problem, for making available the sermon A Pity for the Living. Our gratitude to Mrs. Edith Steinberg. Free time to present the Eternal Life is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. This weekly program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.